Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. The place of religion in American history and American politics is perhaps one of the more hotly debated issues in America today. However, this kind of battle over church and state is certainly not new in America. In fact, our guest this morning, author and theologian Forrest Church, says that religion was the most divisive issue in the nation's early presidential elections, reaching a vicious peak during the War of 1812. He also says, though, that that conflict has helped shape our modern sense of church-state relations. And this morning, we'll be exploring some of this history with him. It's the subject of a recently published book that he has authored. The title of his book is So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. It's published by Harcourt, and it takes a look at how people thought about the relationship between church and state during the first five presidencies here in the United States. The book is recently out, so if you're interested, you can go down to the bookstore and look for it. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. Forrest Church, after serving almost three decades as senior minister, Forrest Church is now Minister of Public Theology of All Souls Church in Manhattan. He was educated at Stanford University, at Harvard Divinity School, and also at Harvard University, where he received his PhD in early church history. He has written or edited 23 books, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I would also like to mention that for people who might be listening to us in the Chicago area, he's scheduled to do a talk and a book signing early next month at North Shore Unitarian Church. That's 2100 Half Day Road in Deerfield, and this is scheduled for Thursday, November 8th in the evening. And I'm certain that anyone who is interested would be welcome there. And here on the program, anyone who is interested in calling in, being a part of the conversation, is welcome too. The only thing we ask is that people try to be brief in their comments so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving along. But anyone can call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Church, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm just fine.
This is, as you say, this is a kind of conversation or debate or conflict or whatever word you want to use that has been going on now virtually since the beginning.
Since the beginning.
And although one might wonder, from time to time, I'm sure there are peaks, and I think that we're at something of a peak now. Is there some particular reason you think why so many people would think that right now that this was a subject of some urgency?
Well, in general, David, at times of war or the threat of war, the line of separation between church and state gets blurred in the same way that there's additional tension placed on all the First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, etc. So as a very rough rule, if you go throughout our history, you can see at times of war, the religious politics become more fierce.
Mm. And something else that strikes me, and you can tell me if this is if I'm painting here with an overly broad brush, but that perhaps one of the things that fuels this conversation is that it seems to me that one can take virtually any position that you like on the church-state relationship and find an important figure in early American history who will support you. And in fact, you might even be able to take two different positions and find the same person in early American history who will support you.
That's exactly right. And if you cherry pick through the statements they make and create a little pastiche of comments, you can make almost any of these characters sound utterly irreverent and secular or magnificently pious and devout. And they themselves did change their minds as this struggle went on. But it certainly is true that the two simplifications, that the founders were Christian and created the United States as a Christian government and were trying to return now to the faith of the founders, and then the secular argument that the founding was an absolutely secular act and we've slipped away from the into a religious morass, both of those caricatures are sort of 100% half right. The early division was just as sharp as it is today, and quite a bit more ferocious.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, if you look at the attitudes that some of these key men held, or even if you just looked at these the five individuals that the first five men to serve as president of the United States, from George Washington to James Monroe, can you say anything of an accurate and general nature about their attitudes? And perhaps, again, here it's important to make some distinction between whatever their personal attitudes
right.
were, their attitudes as an individual about God, faith, church, religion, and then what role they thought God, faith, church, religion should play in the country's civic life.
That's an important distinction. There are two themes that make up the somewhat dissonant music of early American religious politics. One is the theme that comes out of Puritan New England. It's the Commonwealth of God idea, the belief that government cannot endure without a strong moral, even religious foundation. The other is the theme that comes from Enlightenment France. Instead of the Commonwealth of God, it would be the theme of sacred liberty, the notion that each individual should be have his or her liberty and ultimately equality protected as given by God, and that the government tends to interfere with those things, so government should be weak. If you break it down in terms of our Pledge of Allegiance, the Commonwealth of God theme is the one nation under God, and then you have liberty and justice for all. Or if you break it down in terms of our motto, you've got the Unum theme and the Pluribus theme, sort of moral order and sacred liberty. Those themes run through our early religious politics. You have someone like John Adams, who, being out of New England, very much represents the Unum Commonwealth of God idea. Someone like Thomas Jefferson, informed by the Enlightenment, represents the sacred liberty notion. In fact, he dreamt of establishing an empire of liberty. The irony is, as you pointed out in your question, Adams and Jefferson had almost indistinguishable theologies. Neither of them believed that Jesus was the Lord and Savior or divine. Neither of them believed that the Bible was the revealed word of God. But they could not have had more different religious politics.
Mm. This very quickly, I'll introduce again our guest, Forrest Church. He's the author of a new book that looks at the issue of church and state in early America, at least particularly during the administrations of the first five presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. The book is just recently published by Harcourt, and if you're interested, you can head to the bookstore and look for the book. Questions are welcome here too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I suppose we could go through and you could talk a little bit about each of these men and what was being discussed at the time, starting with George Washington. And I suppose what was important in a lot of ways about Washington was he was setting precedent that at least would stand for a little while, although I think it's true. Interestingly enough, here we probably now over two separate days on this program, we'll end up talking about the election of 1800. We talked about that a good bit yesterday with the author of a new book about that. And but it's at least there was a big turning point, 1800. But at least if you looked at what happened before then, George Washington loomed large over the office, and a lot of people looked to him and what he did as a guide to how that person, whoever would hold the person, would be expected to conduct himself.
He was such a dominating personality, David, that he kept the divisions between the Unum people and the Pluribus people somewhat moot during his presidency. He was himself profoundly moral, believed that the nation had to be built on a moral pediment, but he also had a reverence for individual liberty. So he drew from both of these two themes that I was describing before. He was not a Christian in the way that we would associate active Christianity today. He never joined a church. When he would worship, he would stand during prayers, as his wife Martha would kneel. He always slipped out before communion, so he didn't have to be rude by not accepting it. However, at the same time, he believed that we should have a unified nation built on a strong moral pediment. So he established, in some ways, by virtue of the force of his personality, the model of E Pluribus Unum. It was only after he left office that party politics broke into the arena, and the radical divisions that had been building up between the Federalists and the Jeffersonians or Democrats led to that battle of 1800 that you alluded to before.
Mm-hmm. In which, and this is actually something that we really didn't talk about very much in this conversation we had yesterday, but religion and this very issue that we're talking about was indeed a very big issue in 1800.
I think it was the largest issue. It's interesting. Secular historians tend to have a blind eye to the religious nuances, even as religious historians tend to make far too much of the doctrinal disputes and miss the political consequences. But the issue in 1800 religiously, and you have to look at the religious right and the religious left almost in a mirror image of today. The religious right are the Episcopalians, the Congregationalists, the Unitarians. They were the representatives of the old church establishments. They tended to support Adams. The religious left was primarily and most vociferously the Baptists, because they had a strong commitment to church-state separation, freedom of conscience, given that when church and state colluded in the past, they often got the short end, or always got the short end of the stick, being religious outsiders. So the Baptists joined with Jefferson, the deist. The New England church establishment joined with Adams, the Unitarian. And the battle actually turned, Adams believes he lost the election because he declared a fast day in 1798. To pray for God's support in a looming war against France, infidel France. And there were riots in the street of Philadelphia. The way you could tell the two parties apart is that the Christian Commonwealth men wore black cockades, little rosettes in their hats. And the French faction, the Jeffersonians, wore the sacrilegious, infidel, anti-Christian red, white, and blue, because it was the French colors.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federalists made a big point of Jefferson's infidelity, believing that if he were elected, the apocalypse would be near at hand. The Baptists and others celebrated his reverence for sacred liberty. And when he was elected in a very close election, they hailed the advent of the millennium. So the election was rich in sacred overtones.
The thing here that I guess it makes it difficult to say anything simple, straightforward about this, maybe does somehow proceed from the fact that that these men who were involved in starting the country did indeed believe that it was important for the United States to have a strong moral foundation, and that there should be a set of values that people would commonly agree to, and that perhaps the thing that they grabbed onto was Christianity and Christian teachings, even though they personally might not have held to them that tightly in the way that they lived their lives. So there is, on one sense, this idea that, yes, it is important there to be this common moral foundation. At the same time, there did, generally speaking, seem to be this very strong idea that we don't want the government to be messing around in people's personal religious activities. We certainly don't want the government telling, mostly I guess people would say, we don't want the government telling people how to practice their faith. We certainly don't want the government telling people what faith to practice. And that on top of all this, everybody should have the option not to practice any faith at all. Now, and if you mix all this stuff up together, it's difficult. It seems that that's what makes it difficult to say, well, what is the place of religion? What What was it to them? What should it be? Why is it important? And particularly, how do you know? How should we react to those people who would say, "Well, I don't believe in God at all, so you know, leave me alone. I should be able to do that."
Both sides actually had a strong moral and even spiritual foundation for their belief. Sacred liberty was almost a metaphysical ideal. That God, in Jefferson's sense, the God of nature, the deist God, had implanted liberty in each person's breast, and it was the government, often with collusion from the church, that suppressed that liberty. So it was the charge of this new experiment in democracy to provide as much religious freedom and freedom of conscience as possible in order to return people to their original birthright, return their birthright to them. One of the ironies about what happened in 1800 is the sort of established church party, having lost the election, declared that they thought that not only would the government be abandoned by God, but also the churches would collapse. And quite the opposite happened. That's the beginning of the Second Great Awakening, it's called, a kind of religious wildfire across the frontier where Baptists and Methodists and Scots Presbyterians, the religious Democrats of the time, argued that people should build a personal one-on-one relationship with Christ. They thought the government had no business involving itself in that kind of relationship, and so they were kind of the foot soldiers for Jefferson's Empire of Liberty, the most evangelical of the religious forces. And that's when religion began to both first recover and then surge in the country, in lockstep with the growing movement toward church-state separation.
How did they think? And I'm sure that again this differs from person to person about official embodiments of religion embedded in the government, things like chaplains, for example, for the Congress or for the military, things like the practice of having, before Congress begins its work, having someone stand up and say a prayer.
Well, it there was a difference between them, but let me use James Madison as a perfect example. Madison had voted against the chaplaincy when he was in Congress in 1789, believed that it was non-constitutional. Both military chaplaincies and congressional chaplaincy. He thought it would be far more pious of the senators and Congress people if they paid for any religious guidance that they received out of their own pockets rather than out of the nation's coffers. But he never formally, after that vote was taken, attacked the chaplaincies. After he was president, he wrote one of the most remarkable documents I think an ex-president has ever written. It's called a detached memoranda. It has a lot to do with religion. It's a very open, critical assessment, even of his own performance as president. In it, he says that he believes both chaplaincies in Congress and military are unconstitutional. But he goes on to say that law doesn't agitate itself with trifles. And so he dismissed, he said, this is probably going to be with us, even though it's non-constitutional. It probably doesn't rise to the occasion of something that we ought to be spending our precious time agitating over. He was more concerned about the growing wealth and power of religious establishments, and saw that he warned his successors to watch out for the independent power of religion to affect the workings of state of the statecraft.
What do you suppose would they have made, or do we have good a reason to know what they would have made of this now contemporary and continuing conflict we seem to have about religion and public education?
Well, Washington is a good example to respond to that question. Washington believed that we should have a national university. One of his great regrets was that during his 8 years in office, he was never able to convince Congress to establish a national university. This university would draw from people in every state. He saw it as a way to create a ground to train the future leaders of the country. His concern was that all of the various universities or colleges of the time were sectarian institutions that trained people for very sectarian purposes, basically trained ministers. Harvard trained Unitarians, Yale trained Congregationalists, Princeton trained Presbyterians, the College of William and Mary trained Episcopalians. And one of the things that Washington insisted would be there would be no religion in the curriculum of this national university. So that was his dream. He even got very upset with Alexander Hamilton, who wrote his farewell address, by which he is probably best remembered in terms of this twin pillars of morality and religion. He said, "There's nothing about education in this address, and that is the most important part of the uplifting of the citizenry." He's best remembered for something that only half represents his views. It represents the unum rather than the pluribus side of his views.
Let me just take a moment here as we're about to midway through this part of Focus 580 to introduce again the guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Forrest Church. After serving almost 30 years as senior minister, he is now the Minister of Public Theology of All Souls Church in Manhattan. He was educated at Stanford, at Harvard Divinity School, and also at Harvard University, where he received his Ph.D. in early church history. He is the author of a number of books. His most recent explores the territory here we're talking about this morning. The title is So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and State. And the book is published by Harcourt. It is out now in the bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. And questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-2... let me do that again. Here, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Okay. And then there's the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. I think that we're getting a caller here lined up, and we'll bring them into the conversation. Yes. In Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about religious tests, especially around the 1800 elections. I read Frank Lambert's book that you probably are familiar with.
Yes.
And he argues that Hamilton, especially at that time, was trying to sort of impose a voter-imposed religious test. That, you know, the Constitution forbade a federal test, an official test, but that Hamilton, on behalf of Adams, was trying to impose a sort of voter-imposed religious test in the marketplace of ideas. And this is important to me because I study media and religion. So I'm interested in your comments on whether you would agree with that sort of assessment and what you think the relevance of that time is for today, as, you know, we have these voters forums that are happening now leading up to the 2008 election.
Yes, that's a wonderful question. Hamilton, after the election in 1800, as his last political hurrah before he was killed in the duel with Burr, proposed setting up something he called the Christian Constitutional Society. It was, in a way, a religious political action committee. The goal would be, and remember, Hamilton at that point didn't care much for the Constitution. He called it a frail and worthless fabric. He wasn't much of a Christian. He hadn't gone to church for years until actually the last year of his life. He didn't bother with religion at all. But he said, and he used these words, if we wrap ourselves in the Constitution and Christianity, we can assure that no one such as Jefferson, an infidel such as Jefferson, will ever be elected president again. Hamilton was more concerned with Jefferson's political infidelities, his Francophile, leveling, democratic tendencies, than he was with his religious infidelities, because, as I said, Hamilton didn't care much about religion. But he saw the great advantage of using religion and the Constitution together to changed the sixth article of the Constitution, which claims that there will be no religious test for federal office, and to, as he put it, make sure that no one who disbelieves in religion and in Christianity shall ever again be president of the United States. That idea basically failed for lack of a quorum. Even the Federalists in Congress at the time did not want to put their stick in that hornet's nest again. They were weary at that point of the religious politics, and so Hamilton got some takers, but not enough to create any torque for that idea. But it is very much the kind of thing that you're speaking of that happens today. It went on through our history. There was something called the National Reform Association during the Civil War that lobbied strongly to put God and Christ in the Constitution, with very strong support within President Lincoln's own cabinet.
Can I ask a follow-up then?
Sure.
Okay. So what exactly is the role of the press? I mean, at that time, newspapers, and then now, the role of broadcasting and whatever. Because at that time, Lambert is saying that there was a shift to imposing tests in the sort of media sphere, that these attempts to impose a test, either constitutionally or otherwise, through the modifications that Hamilton was proposing, that those failed, and so therefore the efforts to impose tests ended up shifting into the public sphere. So it becomes a sort of mediated, voter-imposed religious test. Do you think that was the case at that time, and is that question relevant now?
Oh, it was the case. As a matter of fact, Jefferson probably won his election by virtue of the fear that dissident Christians, the Baptists, the small sects, had of Adams establishing a state church. The newspapers of the time, recognizing that religion was such a inflammatory and successful tool in either agitating people against Jefferson's infidelity or agitating people against the fear that Adams would establish a state church, became religious broadsheets. Dear God, protect us from this terrifying infidel would be a banner headline. So that was played out very much in the press. And I think you'll find that whenever the people are strongly agitated, the press ends up being in large measure a megaphone for various political interests, has always and will probably always, you're going to see these issues adjudicated in the public square. You can't exclude that. I mean, religion and politics will always mix. What you can do is make sure that you maintain a clear line of separation between church and state.
Well, thanks. I'll let some other callers come on, I guess.
All right. Great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Let's go talk next with someone in Charleston. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Carrying on with what you just said, you mentioned the Madison's warning to be careful to be sure that organized religion didn't become too powerful. I know we've seen recently a lot of talk about the separation of church and state with religious organizations taking stands and coming very close to endorsing candidates. What other sorts of, historically, who's taken heed of that warning, and what sort of steps have they taken?
Well, it's difficult. Obviously, there are some laws about religious organizations being tax exempt, openly supporting candidates. I mean, this is one of the places where that line can be drawn. It can be drawn too far the other way. Jefferson, after he left office, issued an opinion that ministers should never allude to politics, even as they should never preach on medicine, because it is outside of their purview. Not only outside of their purview, but it breaks their sworn and bounden obligation to their congregation never to say anything in the pulpit that any member of the congregation could disagree with. this kind of idealism was typical of Jefferson. It would make it impossible probably for a minister to say anything at all in the pulpit. But there was a concern back then, even as there is today, that religion had become too politicized. What does happen, though, this happens every time the church gets too involved in politics, it ends up getting bitten. You know, if the church and state go to bed together, you know, it's always the church that has to ask, will you respect me in the morning? And the answer is almost always no. So what happened at the end of this period that I discuss in So Help Me God is the New England clergy got so involved in national politics and so strongly opposed the War of 1812 because the United States was allied with faithless France, that when the United States won the war, the New England clergy were branded as traitors, and they were driven from the political field.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe we might just talk a little bit more about Mr. Jefferson, because he's as many historians have suggested, that he's something of a puzzle. He is, after all, you know, perhaps more than anyone else, the person that we associate with the phrase separation of church and state.
Yes.
And he was certainly concerned with connections or entanglements between government and religion. He, for example, when he took the oath of office, apparently he decided to drop the phrase, so help me
That's
God.
That's what I think. I mean,
which Washington, apparently, that was Washington's thing. He put that in there. Mr. Jefferson decided, no, I don't want to do that.
That's right. He at least made wrote a letter to John Marshall, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, and asked, is there any other oath beyond that in the Constitution that I'm required to make as I am sworn into office? As far as I can tell, this has never been dealt with before, this issue, but as far as I can tell, there's no possible explanation for that letter other than his asking Marshall, who was no friend, whether he could get away without saying, so help me God. And I also believe, just judging from reading in between the lines of correspondence written about the time, that what he did was he swore his oath of office, did not say, so help me God. He did not swear it on the Bible. After he'd sworn the oath, he went and kissed the Bible. And that was the way that Jefferson tried to have it both ways. He had a strong belief in church-state separation, but he also wanted to make sure that he did not offend the religious populace. He didn't care about the New England clergy because he said they were too hard-bitten to be redeemed. But most of his tenure in office, this man who'd very rarely gone to church, often went to church. By the way, church was held in the House of Representatives and in the War Department and in the Department of the Treasury and even in the Supreme Court, because there weren't any churches in brand new Washington. So Jefferson, particularly when a Baptist was in the pulpit preaching church-state separation, would go with Meriwether Lewis and trudge down into the House of Representatives and worship, driving his religious opponents absolutely crazy. But you're right that he did have himself a strong commitment to church-state separation. And I consider him to be an Enlightenment priest. He was the most doctrinaire of our early presidents.
Well, was then his public display of religiosity, was that more a matter of political pragmatism than it was of personal belief?
Well, here's what Jefferson believed. He believed that once everyone was properly educated, the way he had been, all Americans would come to the same religious conclusions that he had. He said near the end of his life that by the time of his death, all children born in the United States would be born Unitarian. He didn't mean Unitarian in the New England reactionary sense, but Unitarian theologically, because that's what he thought the science would commend to them. He was not; he did not get his revelation from the Bible. So his feeling was, if you just keep the church establishment out of government, they representing the past, being oppressors, and allow education to take its course, that everyone ultimately would be liberated from bondage to the church, because they would come to the same religious conclusions that he had.
Were there, in what these men said or what they wrote, did they at all voice concerns about the hypothetical? What would happen if the lack of religion was widespread? I mean, if unbelieving became the norm, was that something that they worried about?
This is what Adams worried about it constantly. This is why Adams, who himself was no less or more of an infidel than Jefferson, depending on how you approach it, thought that the church had to have a seat in government, because he was terrified that liberty, given too great a scope, would lapse into license, that people could not be depended upon to act morally, and that you needed top-down authority for that. And one of the ironies, David, is that he was 100% again half right. Liberty and slavery, in the sacred liberty sense of Jefferson, liberty and slavery walk hand in hand together all the way to the Civil War. It's the church groups and the New England establishment church groups that band together and create abolition societies and argue that government should legislate morality. Jefferson was very much a states' writer. He believed in, actually well before Senator Calhoun, he believed in the law of nullification, that if the government should pass a law that was inimical to a state, that the state should be able to nullify it. So that kind of amoral government in the service of giving every individual freedom to be as moral as he or she could be terrified Adams, who believed that people were by their very nature sinners, and gave Jefferson a kind of idealistic warm rush, because he believed that people were by nature good, and it was government that had held them down.
Well, let's go again to another caller, Shumway, our toll-free line 4. Hello? Yes,
I have a question I would like to ask you. When was this changed, whenever you took an oath of office, from so help me God to I do?
It's a great question. You know, there wasn't, there were no video cameras back then, and we don't have texts of any of these ceremonies. There are even people who argue that that George Washington didn't say "So help me God" after his inauguration, because the actual statement that he did was not written until about 60 years later, albeit by a person who'd been an eyewitness there, Washington Irving, but as a young boy. My own research leads me to believe that it's very likely that Washington did say "So help me God." It would be the natural thing to do, because you said that at the times of oaths, and also the correspondence with Jefferson that indicates that he decidedly did not want to say it. But we know for sure only that in the late 19th century it became the practice, and I think it became the practice when people started modeling their inaugurations explicitly on Washington's inauguration. I'm not sure what happened in the interim. One interesting side note to this is that the most religious president of the first, sort of the most pious, let me put it that way, most pious president of the first six, John Quincy Adams, showing how completely church and state had finally been separated after the War of 1812, when John Quincy Adams was sworn in, he swore his oath of office on the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, not on the Bible. So that is as clear a symbolic indication of how clear the line of church-state separation had been drawn by that time, as I can think of.
Okay, I have one other question, and then I'll take your answer
sure.
on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the Quran being introduced in this our schools and so on. Do you think that this will be, in other words, when a person goes to court, he will be asked if he swears on a testimony will be on a Quran or on a Bible? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. At this point, one does not swear on Bibles or Korans in the courts. One only swears that one's testimony is true. So I would expect that in the spirit of the pluribus side of our E Pluribus Unum, that we would maintain a certain amount of discretion in not having any of these texts be the one true bona fide text to determine a person's authenticity. Jefferson said, and he had to, this very statement came back to bite him, but he said it's in our lives and not in our words that our religion must be read.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people will recall, I think it's just an interesting footnote that it was, I'm not sure how recently it was, but it was recently that a man was elected to Congress who was a Muslim, and he elected to take the oath of office by swearing on the Quran. And interestingly enough, they managed
Jefferson's
to find
Quran.
One. It was Jefferson's Quran. Yeah.
It was Jefferson's Quran. I have an interesting story to that, addendum to that. My father, Frank Church, was United States Senator. He was elected in 1956, and he was the last class of new senators to receive as a gift, and this had been happening, as far as I can tell, ever since 1904, a copy of the Jefferson Bible. The Jefferson Bible had been printed in 1904 by the government printing office, and they had lots and lots of copies of it, and they didn't know what to do with them, so I guess they gave them to senators when they were inaugurated, when they were installed in their offices. And what's interesting about the Jefferson Bible is that, and I've edited the most recent version of it, it doesn't have the virgin birth. He cut it out. He cut out the resurrection. He cut out all of the miracles. He cut out the Last Supper and just left in the moral teachings. He called it the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Did it twice during his lifetime for his own benefit. And it very much reflects the kind of Christian Jefferson was. But I think it's ironic that the government should have been handing out Jefferson Bibles. Jefferson himself would have found it a completely unseemly thing to do.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. And we have a caller here where we are in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. It's an interesting topic. I guess I have a comment, and then I'd like a reaction. Does it not seem so hypocritic that Jefferson, who we want to say that was a Christian and religious, he had slaves that he went to bed with? I mean, that to me is the height, the ultimate height of hypocrisy. And I find it kind of insulting to even hear us talk in terms of him being religious. How can you be religious and do something so immoral?
As I said, his comment that it's in our lives and not our words that our religion must be read did come back to bite him. This issue was raised even during his lifetime. It was rumored about and bandied about in the press throughout the 1800 election, even in his re-election campaign in 1804. The quandary about dealing with Jefferson and his slaveholding, Madison of course held slaves too, Washington let his slaves go, liberated them upon his death, but Jefferson did not, bound for many reasons, part of them economic, to his own sins. Jefferson is a complete, it's almost less of a hypocrite, I think, than an incredibly gifted compartmentalizer, so sort of better living through rationalization. He believed that slavery was absolutely evil, that if it didn't end, that God would punish us for it, that God would be on the side of the slaves. I mean, there's no more eloquent testimony anti-slavery than Jefferson's. At the same time, he believed, just as deeply, that white and black could not live together freely in this country, and that the only way slavery could end is if all the black people were to leave. So he was in favor of finding a colonies around the world to send the blacks to. Until those colonies were found and a process was established for exporting the blacks, he thought that to free the slaves would lead to a premature civil war, bloodshed, etc. And so he had this. He painted himself into a corner. His belief in justice was trumped by his fear of chaos and his own misogyny. Not misogyny, but opposed to miscegenation. And then there's the irony of his apparent having mixed-race children. And that, again, we can't go back and determine this. It was either he or his brother. It's not certain that it was he, but it was. It's likely it might have been. So, like almost every one of our leaders, he, when you see more about him than he wanted us to see, becomes a very complicated figure.
Does that caller, does that get at your question?
I still think of him in a very high esteem. I find that insulting because he may have wanted blacks to go to some other place, but he certainly wanted to place his seed in the black slave women. I just find it appalling.
But you are certainly not alone. As I said, from the very beginning of our history, there are many people who believed exactly that. And he does present an enormous moral challenge to those people who idolize him. I am not one of them, but there are many who continue to do so.
All right. We just have a couple of minutes left. I have one more caller. I want to make sure we give them a chance. This is Champagne, and it's line two.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm a Quaker, and I wanted to go to the a couple issues. One is the swearing.
Mm-hmm.
Quakers don't swear because there is one one standard of truth.
Right.
And this caused a lot of trouble for a lot of years. I think there was probably a court case, but I can't remember that for sure. But nowadays, they just ask you, do you swear or affirm?
Well, I affirm, but that was put into the Constitution from the very beginning. That in the presidential oath it says I solemnly swear, and then it has in parentheses or affirm. That was done both for the Quakers and the Mennonites, who did not swear in courts of law. The only president I know of that affirmed and didn't swear was Franklin Pierce. Strangely enough, I will have to look into. What his scruples was, given that he wasn't either a Mennonite or a Quaker.
Oh, what about Hoover? Because he was a practicing Quaker at the time he was a president.
That's right, and to my knowledge, and again, I'll have to check this out. I have not. I'm working on a book that will take us up to the present on this, and I have not yet gotten to Hoover or to Nixon, the other Quaker president.
He was not a practicing Quaker.
No, but nonetheless.
He was raised Quaker, but he was not practicing.
It was interesting that the Quakers caused great problem for President Washington because he believed that religious lobbies should not have any role whatsoever in government, and they were lobbying strongly for abolition at the outset of his own presidency. So that was the first example of religious politics and is an indication of how complicated this issue is.
Now, the Quakers have the oldest religious lobby in the United States, 1943 Friends Committee on National Legislation.
Right. Well, they had an earlier lobby in 1789 going to the president's mansion and demanding that slavery be ended.
Well, yeah, and Lucretia Mott also went to Grant and asked for Indians to be freed. But then also, you haven't mentioned the Quakers in this religious divide, and the Quakers were at the forefront of every reform movement of the 19th century, including women speaking in public.
Right. I certainly do have a great deal of attention given in So Help Me God to the Quakers and their early religious lobbies.
But I'm wondering if, you know, they would be with Unitarians in terms of the slavery and the morality question, but I'd be hard put to call them conservatives.
Well, they were split. In the War of 1812, the Quakers, Jefferson believed that the Quakers were one of the strongest pro-war groups in the country, and indeed their antipathy for France and their fondness for England did lead many Quakers to support the war over their pacifist principles. So all of these things, you don't get a simple picture about any of these religious groups. The Quakers, it seems, voted more heavily for Adams than they did for Jefferson, and that can be due to their anti-slavery position, but it also could be due to their rather conservative and deferential understanding of the importance that democracy not run too far amok in the early republic. So these things are quite, as I said, complicated, and they parse in many different directions.
Right, and just one more thing: a lot of Quakers who could moved north of the border during the Revolutionary War, so because they did not believe in armed rebellion.
That is correct.
So a lot of those Quakers were already gone.
That is correct.
From the United States. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we're essentially at the point here where we're going to have to stop. And certainly there is much more we could do here. Just as a way of finishing, Dr. Church, you expect that this is the kind of thing that we're going to continue to argue about?
Yes, I think it's bread in the bone. Religion and politics. Religion will always have a place in politics in this country, and we will be, for the sake of both church and state, we will be wise if we keep our religion to our politics and not into our statecraft.
Well, our guest this morning, Forrest Church, is now Minister of Public Theology at All Souls Church, that's in Manhattan, and is the author of many books, and his most recent, that we've been talking about here this morning, is titled So Help Me God, The Founding Fathers and the First Great Battle Over Church and States, published by Harcourt, out in the bookstores now. And Dr. Church, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, David.